Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 6th of October, and you're listening to Reconstruction with me, David Taylor from the Construction Index magazine, and Phil Bishop, editor of our daily online news service. Morning, Phil.
Morning, David.
How are you doing there?
Yeah, all good. Everything sunny and jolly.
Jolly good. How are you? Glad to hear it. I'm very well as well. Yes.
Good.
Yes, indeed. Well, it's been quite an exciting week in construction, hasn't it?
Well, two things
have happened.
We'll come on to the big news, the failure of NMCN, North Midland Construction, as was.
Yeah.
A £400 million turnover company, round about our 40th biggest construction contractor or so. Biggest collapse probably since Carillion, we could say.
Yeah,
but
well,
let's move on to that in due course. I just want to touch on a few of the goings on in the world of politics as they relate to construction. It being party conference season and the Chancellor's autumn budget coming up and all these sort of things. There's quite a lot going on. Have you been watching? You've been glued to the sets, listening to all the political speeches?
No, I turn off. I mean, I just turn off at party conference season. I mean, I listen to the commentary on the radio and, you know, on television news and stuff like that, because they usually come out with something. There's an awful lot of hot air, of course, at conference season. So, no, I mean, the highlight for me so far was hearing Boris Johnson on the Today programme yesterday morning. I don't know if you heard that. You were probably busy doing news, weren't you?
But I did, but I read about it, him being interrupted.
Well, he wasn't interrupted. He was doing his, you know, sort of normal sort of waffling and trying to deflect possible questions by talking continuously. And Nick Robinson, who was doing the interview, actually said to him, "Prime Minister, stop talking. Stop talking. You know, I'm asking questions, you provide the answers." It was quite good. And then it was hilarious because Boris went into sulky schoolboy mode and made some sort of rather oblique comment a bit later about, I thought you wanted me to stop talking. So it was a very entertaining interview from that point of view.
Yes, I read a lot of comments from in the right-wing press saying how appalling the BBC is and this dreadful lefty Nick Robinson. Robinson, of course, is former, I can't remember, it's the Federation of Conservative Students or the Young Conservatives, but he's a former leading light in the Conservative Party movement in his youth.
Yes, indeed. I know that it's said a lot that, you know, the BBC being such a high-profile sort of news outlet is constantly criticised from both sides. And, you know, the Corbynistas were always going on about Laura Koonsberg and her right-wing bias and the fact that she was out to get... She's out to get
and she's
Jeremy
from a Labour
Corbyn
Party family, of course.
Yes, of course, yeah. And she's... I have friends, and I'm not ashamed to admit this, who are
dyed
in the wool. I have dyed in the wool Tory friends, who I was discussing over supper not long ago, and they were laying into Laura Koonsberg with a huge amount of vitriol for her left wing bias. So I mean, I think.
Did you know that Laura Koonsberg's father used to be chairman of GAP, the plant hire company up in Scotland?
No, well there we are.
He's a man with fingers in pies in Scottish business, is Nick Koonsberg, but including Gordon Anson Plant in the past.
Well, there we are. Absolutely. Well, you know, and I think that if an organisation like the BBC gets such an equal amount of vitriol from both sides of the political spectrum, they are indeed doing their job correctly. And I think actually... Oh, this is going off on a tangent. But I think a lot of people who actually consume journalism don't really understand what it is, which is ironic. It's rather like sort of, you know, eating bread and not really knowing what it's made out of.
Isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. But that's by the by. I'm sure all our listeners know exactly what we're up to because we're very, very transparent on this podcast.
Well, I, like you, I haven't been watching the party conferences at all, but I've been following the press commentary, and my favourite line actually came from Keir Starmer, surprisingly. Not a man famous for his humour, I don't think, but I thought did you hear his joke? It was actually proper funny for a politician.
Really? No, I hadn't heard that.
Keir Starmer: my dad was a toolmaker. Although in a way, so was Boris Johnson's.
Yeah, pretty good.
Bit rude maybe, but hey, cut and thrust of politics. I mentioned Gap Plant, or Gap Hire, I should say, a moment ago. Did you see pictures in the paper of the Prime Minister on the Sunbelt Rentals stand? Sunbelt Rentals, surprisingly to my mind, has a stand at the exhibition that accompanies the Conservative Party conference in Manchester this week. I mean, normally the Conservative Party conference, and as did the Labour one, I think every year they have a little business exhibition for people who want to basically lobby politicians. They pay some money, and it's a good way of the parties are making a bit of cash for themselves to beef up their finances. But traditionally, it's things like, I mean, odd things often, like the Falkland Islands and Scotch Whisky Association, and you know, people who are saying, basically saying, don't forget us, we're here.
Yeah.
And Sunbelt Rentals, they've got a digger in the hall in the Manchester, whichever exhibition centre it is in Manchester.
A nice green one, I understand. It was a
Volvo electric mini excavator. I've seen various people tweeting pictures of themselves sitting in it and going, ooh, look at me, I'm in a digger. I've not seen a plant hire company exhibiting at a party conference before, and I'm not quite sure what its message was. Obviously, Sunbelt has done very well, nicely out of government money over the past couple of years with all the COVID testing stations and things that it's been involved in setting up. I mean, it's worked hard and it's earned its money. I'm not suggesting anything wrong with that at all, but it has gained, I suppose, a political profile.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a Tory party donor, is it? I mean, like JCB. I mean, I would expect to see JCB there because, you know, Lord Bamford is quite well known as being a Tory party supporter.
JCB doesn't need to buy a few square metres of stand space to get access to people. JCB's got the ear already.
Well, that's true. I mean, Sunbelt, I would have thought, probably has quite a lot of influence, doesn't it? It's our biggest plant hire in the UK.
I don't think plant hire.
Actually, yeah.
It's not that big a deal, frankly. In the political universe, I should say. Of course, it's a big deal. But anyway.
Well, it's probably the brainchild of one of their marketing people, I imagine. And it's got us talking about it, so it's obviously worked.
Yeah, yeah, and a lot of you know, pictures in the press of Prime Minister in it, you know, and they all.
But you see, you put a digger anywhere in front of Boris Johnson, you know he's going to climb in the cab and start clowning around, don't you? I mean, anything like that, it's his bread and butter.
It's not the first one, though. I can remember photos of Margaret Thatcher taking great joy climbing into JCB cabs.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true.
And in terms of political announcements, the only thing I've heard which is new and interesting is the Home Secretary Priti Patel. And for about an hour on our website, until you pointed out to me, I'd mistyped it or autocorrected, had called a proto Patel.
Yeah, which I thought was deliberate when I first saw it.
our proto Home Secretary Priti Patel she announced that. On the back of all these Insulate Britain people lying in the road and holding up traffic on the motorways, causing all sorts of problems for normal, hard-working people. And ironically, we discover that the prime organiser hasn't even got round to insulating his own home yet.
I didn't know that, really.
Yeah. He was busted on TV and he stormed off a TV set. So, yeah. Anyway. On the back of that, Priti Patel has said, we're going to clamp down on this and unlimited fines and up to 6 months imprisonment. Currently, the maximum fine is only £1,000, so stepping that up. But also introducing a new offence called obstructing construction. So it's not just obstructing the highways. It's this is a sort of the anti-swamp.
So they've got one eye on HS2, presumably.
But yeah. I hope they're not going to keep too close an eye on Terminal 5 if it ever happens, because the Prime Minister has already promised to lie down in front of the bulldozers there, as we remember.
Yeah, absolutely. So he could get himself into deep trouble.
Yeah. So anyway, interesting that new powers. This is there's already a police crime sentencing and courts bill going through the House. It's in the House of Lords at the moment, or it's in Parliament at the moment, and they're going to add some amendments to that to up the sanctions on the penalties on people who block construction projects.
No more gluing yourself to the road.
I think it's an open goal for the government. I think there'll be a lot of support for that proposal. But I'm always slightly... some of these things, it's a bit like the old dangerous dogs legislation, remember? It's a bit of anything that's a bit knee-jerky. You know.
Yeah.
Another government, which a different type of people might want to protest against, might suddenly find that avenues for protest get narrower and narrower and narrower.
Yeah. I heard it discussed again on the radio yesterday, possibly, maybe the day before. George Monbiot, who's quite the well-known sort of environmental journalist, was actually making quite a good point. Because, I mean, I haven't got an awful lot of time for these Insulate Britain people. I mean, especially if they're as hypocritical as you've just indicated. But, I mean, I can't remember who he was discussing this with on the radio. But it was said that you can't have people going around acting dangerously and disrupting society like this. And they're not doing themselves any favours because, of course, it turns public opinion against them. You know, if you're trying to get to work or something like that, or even worse, trying to get home from work, and somebody's glued themselves to the road, you know, you're not going to be particularly well disposed towards their cause. And George Monbiot said, well, you know, people have to make themselves objectionable in order to get things over. And he talked about the suffragettes and Gandhi and people like that. They're all people who made themselves a nuisance.
Yeah, those bloody suffragettes ruined a perfectly good horse race at Epsom one year, didn't they?
They did indeed, yeah. But in the end they prevailed, and so I suppose there's a strong tradition, especially in this country, of people making themselves a nuisance in order to make a point. And if you don't make yourself a nuisance, well, maybe people don't really notice you, so you're not getting your message across.
It's making yourself a nuisance is putting lives at risk. And if someone's someone to hospital and for an emergency operation, and they can't get there, and they're stuck in the road, or they haven't got their medication they need to have every few hours, and they're stuck there for 12 hours in the motorway. I mean, yes, they have to make a nuisance of themselves to get their message heard. They don't have to endanger life and limb, I don't believe.
No.
But anyway, moving forward from the party conference stuff, and looking forward, the next big event in the political calendar is the Chancellor's Autumn Statement, which comes up next month at some time. And obviously this is always accompanied by the usual round of trade associations and vested interests writing letters, open public letters, sending them to press saying, this is what we're asking for in this budget.
Yeah.
We've got the construction industry's submission comes from the Construction Leadership Council. I'm sure other subgroups will have their own particular requests into the Chancellor, but the sort of overreaching one comes from the Construction Leadership Council in the form of a letter. And unusually, whereas in every other year it's always been, we're important, give us more money, please. This time it's a case of, we know there's no more money, so we're not going to ask for more money, but please can you not cut anything? Just keep going as you are, don't cut anything.
That's remarkably restrained, isn't it?
The small print, the only small thing they're asking for is they want an extension. Do you remember, we've talked about this before, if you take on an apprentice at the moment as part of the post-COVID recovery measures, the government gives you a bung of £3,000 or something, and that expires soon, and they want that to be extended a bit longer. But other than that, it's just, no, please don't cut things, because the money that does go into construction is what's the word? It's progressive. It generates more money. It's an economic stimulus, and
but of
so
course
on.
The Construction Leadership Council, which sent this letter to the Treasury, it is sort of co-chaired by a government minister, Lee Rowley, isn't it? And I just wonder if maybe Rishi Sunak had a quiet word with him and said, don't push your luck, son.
This is a strange. This is what's so odd about the Construction Leadership Council. Its secretariat is provided by civil servants from the Department of Business, Enterprise and Industrial Strategy. It's one chair is the construction minister, who this week is Anne Trevelyan, don't know who will be next week, someone from industry who has been Andy Mitchell from Tideway for the past couple of years now. He's been in the seat for quite a while, I think. Construction Leadership Council has done great work, as we said before, on setting the new operating work procedures to get construction back up and running in pretty quick order after the first lockdown, and done lots of good stuff. But when it comes to lobbying, is it government? Is it industry? I mean, it's still unelected and undemocratic, but it started life as the minister's, six favourite business people, CEO club. And it's not that anymore. It's got lots of trade associations represented. It's got not just some contractors. It's got the professions, the people from manufacturers, all sorts of ends of the industry are involved in the Construction Leadership Council. I would like it to be more. It's representative, but not accountable or democratically representative. I would like that to happen to it. It needs to transform, I think. But maybe if it didn't have the secretariat from the Department for Business in there, it wouldn't have the influence and access that it has.
So that's probably true.
Works both ways.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it does sound a little bit feeble, doesn't it, to say, I know you're not going to give us any more money, but please don't take any of it away. But I suppose the other side of the coin is that they're just being pragmatic. And after what we've been through with COVID and all the debt that the government has racked up, it would be rather unhelpful, perhaps, to start demanding more money for this, more money for that. I mean, we've got some big infrastructure projects already underway. The industry is still quite busy dealing with all that workload. Keep the money flowing. Don't take it away, but maybe it would be unrealistic to expect them to actually shovel more in our direction.
I disagree with you. It sounds pathetic. Maybe the way I paraphrased a three-page letter down to one sentence makes it sound that way. Mm-hmm. I think your second point about it being pragmatic. I mean, if you start being stupid in these things, you lose your credibility.
Yes.
Much better to sound like a grown-up and say, look, we get it. We know what's going on, but here's the story. Mm-hmm. So I think Andy Mitchell's letter. And I don't know if it's all his own work or it's just his signature and someone else's the brains behind it, but it seems perfectly sound to me.
Yeah, I think so. And, I think that the budget is going to be quite interesting this year because, of course, they've stopped the furlough and the SEISS, can't remember what that stands for, it's the
self-employed support scheme.
That's income support scheme. Yeah, that's just come to an end. So, a lot of the support that the government has been providing to industry over the last 18 months is beginning to fall away, and people are going to have to learn to walk on their own again. So, I think that was that the point that Boris Johnson was trying to make, going back to the party conference. He was saying, having a go at industry, wasn't he, saying that, or at business, saying that they really, we've been holding their hand, and a lot of the time, this business about the shortage of lorry drivers, for example, is, we can't control it, and it's about time that that the business community took control again.
I don't often agree with him, but I think I do on that one.
Yeah. Well, I think maybe we might see that sentiment reflected in the forthcoming budget. So everybody's had a helping hand over the last 18 months. And it's, of course, it's made Rishi Sunak very popular. But he might destroy all that come the budget. So the big story of the week then, Phil. Fill us in on that one.
Yeah, well, I was going to say it started on Friday with a stock exchange announcement from North Midland Construction. It didn't. It actually started last year, really, yeah. When last summer, I don't know if you remember, North Midland Construction, their finance director, who'd been there for 7 years, left. And then a few weeks later, the chief executive suddenly departed with no particular reasons given. And it then emerged that they started, launched an external investigation into what money that they could expect from some of their problem accounts, yeah. Problem contracts that they had on. And over the course of the past year, really, we've had intermittent, ever-increasing profit warnings from NMCN. Then in June, I think it was announced, a company called an investment company called Svella, who are not Swedish at all, but from Carlisle, an investment company set up by a couple of former executives of Stobart, the trucking company.
Yeah,
that they were going to basically inject loads of cash into NMCN, save it, and would take majority control of it of the business. This required shareholder approval,
yeah.
And they couldn't do the necessary... There are all sorts of city rules about how you have convene shareholder meetings and circulars and prospectuses for refinancing deals and so on. And for reasons beyond me, the prerequisite of this, or one of the prerequisites, that they had to sign off their 2020 annual report and accounts,
yeah.
Which they'd been struggling to... The new chief executive that didn't come until May, the new finance director, and new auditors, coincidentally. The change in auditors had to happen because the term of BDO, two terms they'd done, had completed, and they had to get new auditors in. And so in amongst this, all this change of new people involved and problem contracts, not quite sure what's going on with those, they were unable to finalise the accounts. Meanwhile, they kept going to their banks, Lloyds Bank, I think, primarily, saying, can we have that our overdraft, can we have it extended a bit longer? Mm. And they kept getting it a little bit longer with their overdraft. And that was all set to finally expire on the beginning of next month, I think, was the end line for that.
Mm-hmm.
And the announcement that came out on Friday last week, they said that the previous final last deadline, they said that they were working to get their accounts signed off, they weren't going to hit, so it's all a bit tricky. And then on Monday this week, they said, having taken advice, the company is no longer able to continue trading as a going concern. We've got administrators on standby to come in with filing.
Yeah.
File notice of intent to appoint administrators. So it all collapsed. I mean, they had money. They had a white knight, a saviour. There's people there with a pot of cash saying, we like you, we want you, here's our money. Get it past the shareholders. And 48%, I think, of the shareholders were all members of the same family. The guy who founded the business way back when, in 1946, Major Terence Moyle. His son, Robert Moyle, was still... He'd been chief executive of the company for a very long time, handed over the reins of chief executive 5 years ago or something, and became chairman. But Robert Moyle's family still own, it's either 42 or 48% of the shares. And the shareholders had indicated they were going to support this plan. So the plan was all lined up, agreed, approved, it was all going to go happen, but they couldn't get the account signed off. And that, I'm not an accountant, it sounds weird, but it's been explained to me that this is a post-Carillion fallout, that when Carillion went pop, it was revealed that the accounting had been very aggressive, the auditors were, or are, still being hauled over the coals. We'll wait and see what happens, but the investigations continue. And the whole issue is the extent to which construction companies are allowed to say that money they will earn, that they expect to be paid from ongoing work, is already in their bank.
Mm.
Now, you and I don't work like that. When we file our tax claims or accounts or whatever, only money that actually has landed in our bank account,
even
unpaid invoices don't count.
No.
It's got the money's got to be in the bank account, and then that's money that we've earned. Somehow, construction companies operate in a different way.
And is it something unique to the construction sector, or do other businesses do this?
You need to ask an accountant that question, David. I can't answer that. But I think that the issue of the new accountancy standard, is it IFRS 15, mm-hmm. I think, is the standard, relating to accounting for expected income, is something I believe is certainly every publicly quoted company is going through this pain of saying,
right,
okay, well, we thought we had this amount of money, but actually we don't, because the way that the losses that NMCN went from I think it was about 15 million, they first said they were going to be down a year ago, or 13, 15 million a year ago, they said they were going to be down, and by the end, it was 43 million going to be down. I don't think that was quite so much just because they were suddenly doing really badly on two big water projects that they're involved with. They have had their problems, but it's not so much that.
Mm.
It's looking backwards. It's revising previous accounts and looking forwards into the 2021 accounts and trying to work out what's going on. Now, I'm in over my head on this one as to what the detail is of how the accountancy procedures work and exactly what the financial reporting standards say. But the bottom line is, they couldn't get, this company was unable to sign off its accounts, which seems to me extraordinary. And it's nothing to do with whether it could build things or not. It was an accounting issue.
Talking about building things, I mean, what happens on their sites? They must have several live sites around the country. Are they continuing with those, or have they just been mothballed?
I don't know. I haven't heard. Certainly, they can't be mothballed.
The
work will have to go on, be novated, and that becomes a process for the administrators.
What about the employees?
Same deal. It'll be horses for courses. There'll be some projects where the work will be novated to. Yeah, there might be a major subcontractor who will step up to the plate, or there might be. And I can't talk to specifics of any of these cases, but we've seen enough construction companies go bust in the past. That, yes, there are projects where the doors shut, everyone goes home and you know, goes to the pub and drowns their sorrows, and that's it, Gov. Have a nice Christmas. And there'll be projects where maybe the client will take people on board. Certain bits of the business will be snapped up really quite quickly, I think, by interested competitors. Mm. And let's not forget, there are huge skills shortages around the construction industry.
Yeah.
If you're going to get laid off from a construction company, now is a good time. If ever there's a good time to lose your job, now is not a bad time to lose your job comparatively.
No. Yeah, well, I mean, it's always sad when you see a business like that go under. And I have to admit, although I hadn't been watching their performance particularly well, I did notice I did have it up on the screen, but they were in our top 100 contractors last month. And their figures look fairly healthy.
Their 29. That was their 2019 figures.
Yeah, exactly.
They haven't got their 2020 figures yet, and their 2019 figures, as reported, did look healthy.
Yeah,
but of course, there were costs which had not been attributed to those figures, which is part of the problem for 2020 in trying to untangle the accounts.
Yeah.
So, pre-tax profit of 7.5 million on turnover of something over 400 million.
Yeah.
£26 million cash in the bank. No
Looks
sign
pretty good,
at that
doesn't
stage.
It?
Yeah, I mean, NMCN had their problems in the past, you know, 10 years ago or so. It was often, you know, teetering around the making losses or small profits or whatever. But that it seemed that it got through that.
Mm.
But sadly, no.
Shame. It was certainly one of the more visible sort of regional contractors. You know, I know there are a lot of them around the country, but NMCN seemed to always be doing something. We were always hearing about them.
Well, they would never regard themselves as a regional, or not for a while, they would regard themselves as a regional contractor. They changed their name from North Midland Construction.
Yeah, exactly. That must have been
5 years ago to NMCN. My only bugbear with them as a company, we've mentioned this before, nothing against them as a company, but that stupid cutesy little N, little M, little C, little N, you know, branding it all lowercase, which just annoys me, I'm afraid.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's one thing you won't have to worry about now, Phil. Phil, I think it's time to introduce our guest. We're very pleased to have with us today Ayo Ogunbambi, who is a project engineer with Balfour Beatty. She's an electronics graduate from Exeter University. She's been with Balfour Beatty, I think, for about 4 years now, maybe a little over 4 years. Welcome, Ayo. Great to have you on. You're here to talk about a slightly different part of your job, because you've only been with Balfour Beatty for about 4 years, but you're already mentoring somebody, aren't you? Tell us who you're mentoring.
I reverse mentored our chief executive officer, Leo Quinn.
So, Ayo, you're now running the company, is that right?
apparently, but no. If only being CEO of a billion-pound company was as easy as that, but no, very far from it.
So, tell us all about it. What is this reverse mentoring program?
So, it's something that started over 2 years ago. It originally started in our major projects division, and then it was decided that, okay, we should also do this with the executive committee. So the executives over the whole organization. Reverse mentoring tips traditional mentoring on its head. You have normally a junior member of staff, and they're in a topic that they know quite a lot more about than a senior member of staff. So rather than a senior member of staff mentoring a junior member of staff, you have someone who's junior mentoring someone senior in the topic that the junior member of staff knows a lot more about. Traditional reverse mentoring was first done to bridge the IT gap in knowledge when we had the computer boom and technology boom. That's how reverse mentoring actually traditionally came about. But it can be used for lots of other things such as diversity and inclusion. And D&I is what we used it for in Balfour Beatty.
D&I is what?
Diversity and inclusion.
D&I. Sorry, I thought you said D&I.
Okay. Yes, sorry.
No, that's okay. That's what you are reverse mentoring Leo, or have been reverse mentoring Leo Quinn with. Yeah, okay. I can see the IT origins of this, because obviously you get old dinosaurs who, you know, grew up with manual typewriters and stuff like that, and non-mobile phones. Who are we talking about, Phil? Oh, me and you.
Oh gosh.
And then you've got new recruits who know all about it. But you're different because you're a young black woman, and so you can speak. You know a lot more about diversity and inclusion than perhaps somebody in Leo Quinn's position. So that's your role, is to try and sort of spread the knowledge.
Yeah, I'd say one thing as well that's really important is that a lot of people who don't fit the STEM stereotype, when they're hired into companies or roles, they think they have to take on the token role and be the educator. And it can be very burdensome sometimes. When I chose to join the reverse mentoring program, I was already involved in diversity and inclusion at Balfour Beatty. I was already had training about how to deliver talks. I was already a co-chair of the Multicultural Affinity Network, because I don't want people to think, oh, they saw young black girl teach our CEO. It's like, no, I was already doing quite a bit in the D&I space. You don't have to, if you're joining Balfour Beatty and you're not a young white man who has no neurodiverse traits and is able-bodied, you don't have to think, oh, I have to educate people on this or tell people about that. No, it's more about those of us who are interested can get involved in D&I, the same with anything else. And then as you get training in that area, they're not just, oh, Ayo, it's your opinion. I did have training in various things as well. Then you can do some work in it to try and help the organization.
Right.
Yeah, that's very important.
So the mentoring you did with Leo Quinn, I get the impression it took the form of various meetings. Were these face-to-face meetings or during COVID, you know, Zoom meetings? How often, how, where?
It was a mixture. So it was pre-COVID is when it started, and we tried to meet face-to-face. You can definitely build rapport and get better quality conversations when you're having them face-to-face. As it continued during COVID, they transferred onto Teams. They'd be about every month or so, for at least an hour, maybe an hour and a half, maybe two.
So was it very formal? I mean, was it in your diary, or could you dial him up, or could he contact you when he felt like it? And
He's a very busy man.
I imagine you're pretty busy as well, aren't you?
I tried to become besties with his personal assistant, right. To be honest. Lisa's great. She was my in.
That's always a good plan. That yeah. I would say to any young person starting out their career or early in their career, the most important person in an organisation is the boss's PA, much more important than the boss. Yeah.
So Lisa is, I tried to, you know, because Lisa's the one who controls Leo's diary, essentially. And so with these things, we'd have to book it at least a month in advance. Sometimes there could be last minute things like the half year results. And obviously that is more important. Sure. I might think differently, but apparently that's more important than our conversation. So I have to reschedule. But we still met frequently. And the reason that could happen is because even if he's busy, he's committed to it.
Yeah.
So that's another big thing about the success as well. Both people need to want to make the mentorship work.
And of course, the reverse mentoring at Balfour Beatty isn't just you and Leo Quinn, but there are other people in the, you know, across. I did see some figures, actually, and I can't remember how many people are involved in this, but it's quite widespread, isn't it?
Yeah. So we have different cohorts. I was the first executive committee cohort, we call it EXCO for short. So all of the managing directors of our various business units, Rail, UKCS, Power T&D, Investments, Living Places, etc., and then Leo, they all had a mentor from a different part of the business. And if they, it wouldn't be the same business unit. So say someone was the managing director of Investments, they wouldn't have someone from Investments. It would be someone in Rail or someone in UKCS. Yeah, just so you can get that broad understanding. That one finished, and then we started up another one. Leo and I just get on, so we've stayed in contact and we still talk. But there's been another cohort with the executive committee so that they can actually get a different perspective, because diversity and inclusion, it's more than, you know, just race and gender. There's neurodiversity, there's abilities, there's LGBTQ+ as well. Mm-hmm. And whereas race and gender are the obvious visible differences, there are invisible differences that do bring diversity to the table. So it's important that with the senior leaders, they could get that broader perspective as well.
Yeah.
It can't just be we have a great gender plan and we don't do anything for anything else.
I've seen the video that's been posted by Balfour Beatty on Facebook and YouTube, on socials and so on, of you and Leo reflecting on, it's quite a short film, and I recommend anyone who's interested in what we're talking about to have a look at it. And the pair of you are talking about, or reflecting on what you got out of it. And I think from that, it's clearer what you got out of it, in a sense. And I suppose it's naturally more obvious for someone early in their career to get that access to the CEO of a company the size of Balfour Beatty. Is obviously going to be useful. I can see that. Leo himself also says that it was he found it useful, not so much that he actually learnt anything he didn't know, but to have it sort of reinforced or imprinted or just to keep in his mind things that he needs to keep in his mind. But he wasn't very specific about what those things were in that video. Are you able to help us with that? And it's probably a question for him, I know, but what particular insights do you think were most valuable that he got from you?
One thing that, and I think this is an internal video, it's not external, but Leo, after our reverse mentoring, we've had quite a lot of sessions, and reverse mentoring program for my cohort formally sort of had finished by this point. Last year, you know, there's all those Black Lives Matters protests. So Leo opened a training webinar we had called Let's Talk About Race. And during it, he discussed in more detail how he had learned to be an ally to people who might have either faced an issue, or, you know, what you can do to support them. That's about listening. It's about focusing on the person who has had something happen to them, not about the aggressor. It's about empowering people. Things like the Black Inclusion Plan. So, I mean, the video is 6 minutes, but we did speak for longer than 6 minutes. There's only so much we can put in a 6 minute video. Yeah. But him just giving that advice is one thing I think he got out of it. We get on great, which is another thing he got out of it, being able to talk to someone who he would not normally have any contact with before and getting that alternate perspective. Mm. So, for example, some of the things where he was saying, how are you finding COVID? So he's getting my perspective and feedback rather than just those in his immediate circle. That's another thing. He got out of it disappointment for not getting invited for dinner.
Yes, I noticed that.
So, you know,
but did he invite you? Did he invite you for dinner?
No, that's an excellent point, actually. But I think he wanted to... I kept bragging about my mum's cooking skills. He hasn't bragged about his mother's cooking skills, so I think that's why. that's why he really wants the deer invite. I kept sort of shoving his piece of it, so it makes sense that he hasn't invited me. But yeah, with the main thing, I think in terms of what I can see is and why I joined the program in the first place. Like I said, I wasn't just a graduate with just the engineering. I was already involved in D&I and had been for over a year, is because when you have someone in Leo's position engage in that, the shadow that it casts is quite big. And sometimes it's not what's done, it's who's doing it. And then the ripple effect, there's lots of people who have engaged with reverse mentoring because of Leo just saying that it's a good thing. There's lots of people who might be like, you know what, maybe we should take this policy more seriously because what he's doing is a good thing. And that's something I wanted to get out of it. That maybe Leo might not, because he's just talking about what he thinks is good, he might not see that as getting something out of it. But for me, that's something the business gets out of it, because these issues are taken more seriously. Yeah.
But what did your immediate colleagues make of this? I mean, did you come out of your meetings with Leo and they all come around saying, go on, spill the beans, tell us what he said?
not really, because it was when it happened... I wasn't the only one. There were 12 of us, 12 executive committee members, you know. And also I was still, like I said, I was a graduate at the time. I wasn't going to shout from the rooftop. No. We'd meet, say, in one of the corporate offices. It wouldn't be like everyone there would go and, what are you doing? Cause I work on site. We have offices all over the country. We're not just, you know, one office. So a lot of people didn't know. And then when they found out, I got congratulations, but I'm not the kind of person to be like, oh, be nice to me now. I know Leo. Like, we'd more joke about it. It's just not that kind of culture. Be like, oh, sorry, I better give you a bigger desk because you know the big boss. Or, oh, sorry, like, am I going to get fired for making fun of you? Like, that's more how they would react. It doesn't really change anything in our dynamic.
Yeah, I think it illustrates the sort of, you know, the sort of culture of businesses, you know, Western businesses, that there is always this hierarchy. There's always the boss, and then there's tiers of people below them until you get right down to the bottom, and there's a bloke on site with a shovel, and there are certain assumptions made at all levels of an organization about where people belong and their relative importance on, you know, to the company. So it seems to me that one of the values of this is that, apart from the fact that it's a good way of educating people both up and down, you know, the hierarchy, it also blurs those lines a little bit, that perhaps people don't get stuck in their sort of boardroom silo, assuming that, you know, I've got this great big ship to steer and, you know, I haven't got time for you because you're just over there doing this and that, and I've got to keep my eye on the big picture. It actually makes them focus on individuals at a different level in the organization, and perhaps that has a sort of a flattening effect on the hierarchy.
I would agree, because even before reverse mentoring Leo, backtrack 4 years to when I was first a graduate in Power T&D, which is I'm not sure how personally familiar you are with power transmission and distribution. I know it's a specialist industry. We do overhead lines, high voltage cable and substations and stuff. It was our first day, and we're in the hotel, we were inducted, moving around the UK to meet the different offices, and our MD came over, asked how we were and bought us all a drink. Like, that was my first week. And even just the directors, how they spoke to us and engaged with us sort of right from the start. It's not just Leo. They're all generally very approachable. Yeah. So I think that was even though Leo is quite far away in terms of seniority and levels, when people heard about it. It was just like, yeah, it's not a shock considering the culture now that something like that can happen, has happened, and will continue to happen.
Yeah.
So what are you working on now? I can see we're talking, people listening to us that might guess that we're talking on Zoom. So I can see you're in a site office. Whereabouts are you?
Yes.
What are you doing?
I'm in Dartford on Littlebrook.
I was born there.
I've just moved on to the...
You were born in a power station, David?
No, I wasn't. No. Maple Road I was born in. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you with a...
What's happening in Littlebrook? What are you doing in Littlebrook?
So I am part of the team that is building a whole new substation. So at Littlebrook Substation. And I'll be working with some of the engineers here to do that. I'm not going to go into the finer details because most people don't know what a substation is and don't care, to be honest, unfortunately.
As long as it works.
I find it very interesting.
You care when they stop
working.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, I find it very interesting. So it's always sad there's no one else to talk about it with, but, you know, it's fate of an engineer, I guess.
Because you're an electronic engineer by training, aren't you? That's what you did at university.
Yes, and then power is very electrical, yeah. So there are some things I have to... There's lots of I have had to learn in order to...
Well, what made you want to go into engineering when you were at school? What made you think that? Were you just good at sciences and you thought that's the route for me?
Maths was always my favourite subject at school. I originally liked drawing. Oh, maths is awesome. I resent that. Maths is a great subject. but I wasn't committed enough to the theory to want to do it at university. I wanted something practical. Mm-hmm. When I was 16, we had a woman who was the managing director of her own civil engineering organization come to our school and talk to us about engineering. I went to an all-girls mm-hmm. school, so I think they wanted to, you know, encourage girls to
who
consider
was that?
It.
Do you remember her name?
I wish I did. I would send her a thank you card or something. But she really, I think, had an effect on me. If you're ever listening to this, I went to Woodford County High School. So if someone finds her name, I would like to thank her, but I'm not
that
sure she, that was over 10 years ago. So she might have retired by now, but she had an effect on me. Also, my grandfather was an engineer. He used to work on the rail. My uncle, was an engineer. He worked in telecommunications. So it didn't feel like a far off topic because there are people in my family I could speak to about it. That was the original. And I was also just interested in energy and power and the energy future of the world.
Yeah. Well, it's an exciting area to be in now, isn't it?
It is. But there's a lot going on. So all of those mixed together. And then I chose the right subjects, maths, physics, and history as well. Got into university, thankfully. And
good stuff.
Hey, can I just drag it back to the reverse mentoring? Because there's an aspect.
Yeah, of course.
you talked about how it came from a diversity and inclusion program initiative, and that was how it came about with you and Leo. But it seems to me that while that is completely important, there's a wider thing of the generational differences of young person, old person within an organisation, which whoever you are, I mean, everyone has been young and will be old, hopefully. And I wondered whether there were more, aside from the minority aspects that you talked about, whether it's neurodiversity or gender or whatever else, but just from the very, very general issue of age, did you notice any differences between, Leo the boomer and you the millennial or Generation Z or wherever you come in?
Not really. I think because Leo's very energetic, like he's not like some old person withering in the corner.
That's reassuring, seeing as he's in charge of the biggest.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a better way to say it, but he's someone who is always talking to and engaging with the younger people, with all levels of people, basically from his end, and then from my end, I on site. You know, I'm in power T&D, I'm in construction, I'm on site. Most people will be older than me, so I think it's. Once you've been at work for a while, age isn't as big a deal. It's just, this is another person. What experiences do they have? What can I learn from them? So by the time it come to us, me mentoring him, maybe if he'd never worked with someone under the age of 40 and I'd, in the past, 20 years or I hadn't interacted with anyone above the age of 30 since I've worked, then maybe it would be, oh, generational gap, but we're all just used to working with different people. So it didn't feel like, oh, he's so old. That wasn't, yeah, I didn't really feel a generation.
So you don't, in your working life on site, you don't encounter, machines, for example, which if they're a certain vintage, you're clueless, but on other machines, your elder peers are completely clueless because, the natural, but due to age-related strengths and weaknesses.
I associate it less with age and more with experiences. And experiences aren't always tied to age because I could have someone who's older than me and if they've never worked on a substation before, but they have years of civil experience, it doesn't help them to deal with this old equipment, you know? So I don't really tie it to age as much. I could end up working with a lot of old machines and be more familiar with older technology than someone else who's got more experience broadly than I do. But I don't tie it to age. It's just what areas do you have experience in?
So it sounds like all these training programs that I don't know what Balfour Beatty does, but I know that go on across industry in general of cross generational, managing intergenerational teams and so on. It sounds like in your experience, there's not that much need for that sort of thing.
I wouldn't say there's not that much need for it because in the places where they have it, I don't know what the culture is. I don't know what issues they might have that have led to them deciding that they need that. I can only really speak from my own personal experiences. And even then, like I said, I'm in Power T&D, which is a specialist unit within the big old Balfour Beatty. I'd be very wary about giving a generally sort of groundless assumption about what people in other sites might be experiencing. Okay. I can just say that in my experience, and even talking to the other graduates, yes, a lot of the time we might be the youngest ones there, but it's never really felt like, oh, the only thing that could be that, oh, because of the age difference, some of the older people on site might treat you like, say, a niece or a daughter or that kind of more family, oh, you know, I have to look out for you, I have to look after you kind of thing. But that's just like you treating a colleague as a sibling. They're still treating you as a relation, just one that makes sense to them due to the age difference. So
I can see that.
Yeah.
So it impacts on relationship, the relationship dynamics, I guess. But in terms of capabilities, no issues.
No, I think it depends on the experience and the capability of the person. Just because one thing I've really, and I think this reverse mentoring really emphasized for me is that I was one of the youngest people on the reverse mentoring cohort. So I was genuinely really, really surprised that I had Leo. But we, at Balfour Beatty, it's not about age. And when I spoke to the talent director about it, she was like, you know, it's not about age. It's about what you can bring to the table. And sometimes even if you are younger, if you can bring something, you will be given that opportunity. And I think I am a living testament to that. So,
So you've finished reverse mentoring Leo now. Presumably you're still active in the multicultural affinity network. Are you still getting on with things there?
Because it's Black History Month this month. So there's an activity being planned that I'm involved in. It was National Inclusion Week last week. I'm also involved in the neurodiversity network, which just started this year, but is really, really growing. As far as I'm aware, I don't have any neurodiverse diagnoses myself, but I do think it's really important. I'd always been talking about something I had personal experience about, be it gender or race, or I had close friends with LGBTQ+ that I could speak about. But with neurodiversity, even though it interests me a lot, I don't have personal experience of it. So it's a really good opportunity for me to ally a lot, learn how to ally a different community. And then if I'm speaking to someone about allying from a racial perspective, I understand their position a bit more in terms of where they're coming from. So,
yeah, interesting. I'm not sure I know what neurodiversity is, but I mean, are we talking about sort of, tell us, what is it?
I'm happy to talk about it. Yeah, so neurodiversity is concerned with neurological differences. Mm-hmm. So it could be dyslexia, ADHD, dyspraxia, dyscalculia, OCD maybe, and that umbrella, Asperger's, mm-hmm. And all of those terms. And they're very high, you know, like 1 in 10 people is dyslexic. When I was at university, most of my friends were dyslexic, studying engineering. I think in engineering, it's about 25%. So I think it's really very relevant to STEM.
Yeah.
And considering the skill shortage we have, it's prudent to pay some attention to it for those in the know. And it's also just, I think, such a waste that people, due to barriers and challenges we've had in the past, a lot of people think that they're stupid or incapable, yeah. when actually it's just they haven't been taught in a way that suits them.
That's very interesting, because, I mean, you've just mentioned various, I suppose you could call them conditions, which people would...
Yeah.
you know, normally be advised not to put on their CV. You know, it's the sort of thing that you would not, you would try and hide at all costs when you're going for a job. It's interesting to hear that that's actually now being opened up and being considered more widely.
Yeah, I think it's just less ignorance on the topic. I mean, if we think back to, say, 60 years ago, you would have been seen as bad for writing with your left hand.
Yeah.
There's nothing, apart from all the ink smudges, there's nothing wrong with being left-handed and, you know, like really terrible left-handed scissors. I'm not sure, but generally there's nothing. It's just an alternative way of writing to being right-handed. And that's how I see all these things. You know, you have, say, your own language and they're not just disorders. Mm. They also have advantages. So people with ADHD might be able to hyper-focus more than someone who's neurotypical, refers to a standard or the average person with no neurodiverse conditions or diagnoses.
That's a fascinating topic, actually. Yeah, I've never really thought about it before, but yeah, that sort of thing in the workplace is a fascinating area of study, I should think.
It's not a topic I know much about. I'm loath to even open my mouth for fear of putting my foot in it. But it strikes me that, like many of these things, maybe we shouldn't think of them as absolute. That it's much more linear. That there are degrees, and that, I mean, no one is surely absolutely neurotypical.
Hmm.
Is that fair? Am I?
It is fair. I think all of these things are say a spectrum.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to say.
And and if you imagine say a normal distribution in terms of people being diagnosed, there has to be a cutoff point.
Okay, so normal is within a range rather than a point.
Yeah.
Okay, I get that. Yeah.
So on one hand, we don't want to say, oh, everyone has a bit of OCD, because then it minimalizes and trivializes the challenges that someone might have. But so just because you want all the pencils to be lined up, it doesn't mean you have OCD. But maybe like this trait, maybe someone with OCD, it's because they have it by a magnitude of 50. You have it by a magnitude of 0.5.
Yeah.
And that is the spread. But yeah, we all think differently, of course.
Interesting.
Do these neurodiversity issues, are they fixed with a person? Is that what's with you for life? Or for example, mental health can come and go, and you might always have a proclivity or a genetic something in your genes, but they can come and go. For some of these things you're talking about, are they fixed? I'm talking to you like I think you're a doctor.
Yeah, exactly. She's an engineer, for God's sake.
And while I'm at it, I've got a bad back. Can you help me with that too?
I can do nothing for you. All I can do is smile and wave and hope you get better. But with these things, it's like, for example, if someone's autistic, they're born autistic, you don't cure autism. One thing it's say, for example, you... like even learning how to write, for example, like there's a way to learn how to write, and maybe you have dyslexia and that way doesn't work for you, but everyone else is doing fine with this method. So it takes you longer to learn how to write. But if you were taught in a way that was dyslexia friendly, you could maybe learn at the same pace as everyone else. So it's understanding that when someone doesn't match these things, it's not that they're stupid, but it just means that this doesn't suit the way their brain works, and the way their brain works is sort of fixed. So the dyslexia, a common thing is spelling. So someone with dyslexia might have challenges with spelling, But it doesn't mean that they can't get to the stage where they could spell comfortably or read comfortably. But it doesn't help if they're being forced to do it the way everyone else is and then being told, oh, you're stupid because you can't. A big thing about neurodiversity is understanding where someone's at, so what their strengths and weaknesses are, and also understanding what the objective is and not focusing too much on how to get there, because you can get there in a variety of ways. If I want to get to, say, Mile End, I could cycle. Maybe I could catch a quick plane. Maybe I could get I could walk there. Maybe I could get a car. Obviously, I'd prefer to get a car. But if my objective is just getting to that destination, does the method really matter? Mm. You know. So, sorry, to answer your question properly, Phil, yes or no, someone who is, say, autistic or who has ADHD will always have it. But what they can do is through more research and training, they can actually learn how to manage it better, and things that they might have struggled with before, rather than trying to learn how to do it the neurotypical way, they can learn how to manage it in a way that suits them. And then actually they can... Yeah.
Interesting.
Okay. Have we reached a natural conclusion now, do you think?
We've gone completely off topic.
I knew that would happen. I just good. talk.
Well, no, that's good.
That's fine.
Planned topics are never as interesting as things that barely end up.
Yeah. So are we going to... Should we wind it up, Phil?
Final question.
Okay.
Do you ever get to talk to Leo anymore, or have you had your time with him?
No, I still talk to him. I'm still dangling dinner in front of him like a bone. So, no, we do. I think in a lot of reverse mentorships, not just mine, because you have very honest conversations, you do really sort of bond with the other person, and then you do end up catching up here and there, the same way you would with any other colleague who you get on with that well. So we do have to schedule them because he's so busy, but we do still
great.
Talk. Yeah, it is. I'm very lucky.
Aya, thank you very much for joining us.
No, thank you for having me. Thank you for questions and everything. I'm happy that there was no vacuuming in the background, because
I tell you what,
about seven people have walked in and I've just tried to keep a straight face.
We were talking about maths. What you said really struck home to me, because I was, throughout school, I was maths phobic. I hated maths, it terrified me.
Oh, okay.
And my parents decided that I had to get O-level maths. They were quite right, I did have to get O-level maths. So that I got a private tutor. He taught me in a completely different way. And maths went from being something that I was almost phobic about to my favourite subject. Just for those 2 years, O-level. Went on to A-levels, pure maths, applied maths and physics. Complete disaster. Because I didn't have Mr. Darby anymore. I wasn't being taught by him anymore. So I had to change completely, did arts instead. But I think that's probably what you were describing. It's the way you find out how somebody ticks, and you sort of plug into that. You find out how they work, and then they can function. And that's obviously what my tutor managed to do with me for those 2 years. So, yeah, interesting. Yeah. Food for thought.
Great.
That's why you earned the big
It's really
bucks.
Encouraging to hear.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm so happy to hear that from you, David, because that's something else. Like, in another life, maybe I would be a teacher or something, because when I say I love maths, I think it's an awesome subject. Yeah. But it just, there's so many things where someone might be like, I want to teach in a particular way. It's like, no, what's interesting? What engages with them? Like, I was quite fortunate in that the way it was taught in school suited me, but there are lots of maths, you know, logic, and everyone has logic in some way, that if it was taught in a way that was more practical or could engage people a bit more, they would be able to get the same amount of things out of it. So,
I found what always got my attention in maths lessons at school is whenever they talk about slices of pie or pi r squared.
There we go. How was it? Oh, yes. Or cake. Cake's always good. I like eating. So this is another possible tangent.
Definitely. We're going down a rabbit hole now.
Right.
Yeah.
Hey, you've got a substation to build.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh.
Thank you very much indeed.
It was great meeting
you. Thank
you
for having me. Thanks
a lot.
Great meeting you too. All right.
Bye. Cheers. Bye.
Well, I really enjoyed that. And I was surprised what she was saying about age not being an issue, because certainly when I was in my 20s in a workplace, we regarded anyone over the age of 40 as alien species.
Yeah.
Who would wear handkerchiefs in their top pockets and never blow their nose into them. And ties and things like that.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, strange.
I read on the subject of generational differences, clearly aren't an issue at Balfour Beatty, but there was a piece in the Daily Telegraph this morning, Wednesday morning, I read with some amusement that the New York mob, apparently, the mafia is having generational management problems. Apparently, all the old guard are really concerned that the young guard don't know how to do things properly. That the young up-and-coming mob leaders do things like, "This is your second text message. I won't send you another." Whereas in the old days, they would break one leg and say, "I've broken one leg and I won't, you know, I'll come round later to break the other." So apparently young mobsters don't know how to threaten properly. There's generational differences there, but
I can't really see much reverse mentoring going on in the American mafia. I don't think it would work somehow.
Apart from the youngsters setting the video recorders of the old, but they don't even have video recorders anymore, do they?
No.
Fixing the Wi-Fi of the old effect.
Yeah. Oh well.
Right, so, we're done.
We've gone on
too long again, David. We only get paid for half an hour, don't we?
I know, it's outrageous.
Thank you, everyone, again, for listening. You know where we are now. Podcast at theconstructionindex.co.uk. And give us a... Some people have given us a star. Actually, they haven't. Most people have given us 5 stars. But if you want to give us 1 star, we can take it. But give us 5 stars. On the if you listen to this on Apple, on Apple telephone thingies and podcasts, and
showing your age there, Phil.
I know, but do we like to hear from you? Make a comment, tell people what you think, and we'll be back again next week, I think, won't we, David?
Yeah, we will indeed. Yeah. Hopefully with another guest.
Yes. Okay. That would be good. Yeah. Let's go find someone. Alrighty, yeah. Goodbye. Okay. Thank you very much. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.